From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Russell Banks about his new novel, Rule of the Bone. The narrator is a 14-year-old boy named Bone, who wears a nose ring and a mohawk, listens to Megadeth, steals from his parents to pay for marijuana, gets thrown out of the house, then crosses the line and becomes a real criminal. Banks based the novel on what he learned from teaching in prison and in an Ivy League school. He also drew on his own youth. Also today, doing battle with the status quo on Capitol Hill, we talk with Fred Wertheimer, former president of the nonpartisan citizens lobby group Common Cause. Wertheimer recently stepped down after 14 years as president. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Matthew Sweet's new CD, 100% Fun. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is applauding former President Bush for quitting the National Rifle Association. Mr. Clinton says he agrees with Mr. Bush's letter last week to the Gun Ownership Rights Group. Mr. Bush wrote he was deeply offended by the group's reference to federal agents as, quote, jackbooted government thugs. Mr. Clinton says anyone who attacks federal law enforcement officers ought to be ashamed of themselves. The World Health Organization has reported the first two suspected cases of Ebola virus in Zaire's capital, Kinshasa. This is the first such report in the capital of 6 million people since the deadly disease broke out nearly 400 miles away. A WHO official says two people are being sought so they can be tested for the virus. NPR's Michael Scholar is in Zaire. He says that health workers are asking Zaireans to take extra precautions.
They're trying to get the word out in a variety of ways, both by sending people out to talk to villagers, handing out leaflets that list 9 ways to prevent becoming infected with the Ebola virus, things like don't get any vaccinations for the time being, don't wash the bodies of people who have died and have died with a lot of bleeding. And so they're trying to do a mass education campaign, and now that they're pressing out to look for more cases, it's a chance to tell people directly who have come into contact with people who are infected what they specifically should do. And one of the things they're being told to do is stick around the house, don't have much contact with your neighbors or your family, and we'll keep coming back and checking on you. 3 weeks is about the longest incubation period. So if someone who's come into contact with a patient makes it through 3 weeks, then they're considered to not have gotten the disease.
The World Health Organization has confirmed 84 cases of Ebola virus in Zaire. A high-level U.S. delegation is in Vietnam pressing Vietnamese leaders for help in resolving cases of Americans missing in action from the Vietnam War. The meeting's results will strongly affect when President Clinton establishes full diplomatic ties with Vietnam. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
American business people who would like to see the U.S. and Vietnam normalize relations this year see a 4-month window of opportunity before President Clinton becomes preoccupied with campaigning for next year's election. This week's visit to Hanoi by Deputy Secretary of Veterans Affairs Herschel Gober, Assistant Secretary of State Winston Lord, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense James Wald could well determine how wide that window of opportunity is going to be. They will report to the President on whether they think significant progress has been made in resolving cases of Americans still listed MIA. If their report is positive, the President will then have to decide whether to brave the wrath of the politically powerful MIA lobby and normalize relations with Vietnam 20 years after the end of the war. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 4 points. This is NPR. Japanese police are investigating another mysterious incident of fumes in Yokohama, a city south of Tokyo. One person was hospitalized, several others were sickened. Meanwhile, police have reportedly issued arrest warrants for the leader and several members of the secretive Aum Shinrikyo religious sect in connection with a nerve gassing of the Tokyo subway system 2 months ago. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Events appear to be moving rapidly after 8 long weeks of painstaking investigation into what has become Japan's biggest criminal case in 50 years. The courts in Tokyo have reportedly issued warrants for Shoko Asahara and a group of his followers, charging them with murder. In the worst incident of terrorism to hit post-war Japan, the nerve gas sarin was released into Tokyo subways on March 20th, killing 12 people and injuring more than 5,000. In a development that marked a major break in the case, police today arrested the man believed to have supervised the Tokyo attack. The OHM has consistently denied any involvement, and police sought the voluntary cooperation of its leader, Asahara. He now faces arrest, possibly within hours, for murder. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Two Cuban Americans are being investigated for allegedly smuggling Cuban refugees into the United States. The Coast Guard says the pair were on a Florida-registered boat that was stopped yesterday in the Florida Straits. There were 23 people aboard and the body of a young woman. The Coast Guard says the Border Patrol is investigating. The Basketball Hall of Fame will induct new members tonight in Springfield, Massachusetts, topping the bill, basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He scored more points in his 20-year NBA career than any other player in the game, 44,149 points. His blocked shots record, 3,189, is the league's all-time record. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Russell Banks. The Dictionary of Literary Biography describes his novels as trailer park fiction, books about working-class people living their lives one step up from the lowest rung on the socioeconomic ladder and doing battle every day with the despair that comes from violence, alcohol, and self-destructive relationships. Banks is the author of Continental Drift, Affliction, and The Sweet Hereafter. His new novel, Rule of the Bone, is about a 14-year-old who renames himself Bone. He has all the signs of increasing alienation. He wears a mohawk, has his nose and ears pierced, is doing lousy in school, hangs out at the mall, and spends all his money on marijuana. The book opens with him stealing from his mother and stepfather so he can buy more marijuana. His parents throw him out of the house. After taking up with bikers and drug dealers, Bone crosses the line and turns into a real criminal. The novel is written in the voice of the boy. Here's Russell Banks reading from the opening of the novel.
Anyhow, my life got interesting, you might say. The summer I turned 14 and was heavy into weed, but I didn't have any money to buy it with, so I started looking around the house all the time for things I could sell, but there wasn't much. My mother, who was still like my best friend then, and my stepfather Ken had this decent house that my mother'd gotten a divorce from my real father about 10 years ago, and about that she just says she got a mortgage, not a house, and about him she doesn't say much at all, although my grandmother does. My mom and Ken both had these cheesy jobs and didn't own anything you could rob, at least not without them noticing right away it was gone. Ken worked as a maintenance man out at the airbase, which is like being a janitor, only he said he was a building services technician. And my mom was a bookkeeper at the clinic, which is also a nothing job, looking at a computer screen all day and punching numbers into it. It actually started with me roaming around the house after school looking for something that wasn't boring, porn books or videos maybe, or condoms, anything. Plus, who knows, they might have their own little stash of weed. My mom and especially Ken were seriously into alcohol then, but maybe they weren't as uptight as they seem, I'm thinking. Anything is possible. The house was small, four rooms and a bathroom, a mobile home on cinder blocks like a regular house, only without a basement or garage and no attic. And I'd lived there with my mom and my real dad from the time I was 3 until he left, which happened when I was 5. And after that, with my mom and Ken, who legally adopted me and became my stepfather up until now. So I knew the place like I knew the inside of my mouth.
Russell Banks, thanks for reading that. Tell me how you decided to open the book with the son trying to rob his parents so he could get money to buy some marijuana.
Well, I think I was looking for an occasion that would let a kid, this kid, sort of drop out, drop through the safety net, the last and maybe the only safety net he had and most kids have, which is basically the family. And I had talked to a lot of kids older than this one, you know, in their teens and early 20s, and asked them and just over the matter of time had learned that they had been living on their own, ended up living on their own, oftentimes for a very trivial offense, the kind of thing that almost anybody is capable of doing when you're 14 or 15, robbing a car, robbing somebody, getting into dope or something like that. And it just seemed like the kind of event that would naturally occur to a kid, but might have disastrous consequences. And stealing his mother's coin collection in order to buy weed with was that kind of event. I mean, it's sort of like that's the final straw, you know, that I was looking for. And it's only a straw, but it's the final one. And then he's out, and he's on his own.
How did you know the kids who you talked to about this?
Well, they're all around us, I guess, so just generally. But in particular, I teach college kids, and I have raised four kids myself. And also, I was a couple of years ago working, doing a creative writing workshop with a friend at a prison in upstate New York, and was dealing mostly with 18 to 22-year-old guys who were mostly drug dealers and had all been living on their own, more or less, since they were, you know, in their early teens. And so one of the things we had them writing about was how they came to live on their own. When did you fall out of the nest? And they all told stories more or less like that. Well, you know, I stole a car or something, or I got into a fight, or, you know, they had dropped out of school, and the pieces of their life were falling apart. Their lives are so fragile, and the support systems that surround them are so basically ineffective in dealing with a little crisis that, you know, by the time they were 15 or 16, they were on their own and on the streets.
Were there places in writing Rule of the Bone where you felt you least understood what this character would do or say?
That's a good question. But I have to be honest with you. I don't think so. I think once I was listening to him and sufficiently immersed in his world, I pretty much felt confident that I knew what he would do in a given situation. I didn't always know what the situation was going to be, certainly. But no, I don't think that I had to puzzle it out too deeply or too carefully. It just seemed to come to me very quickly and automatically.
You have some things in common with the character in your book. Your father was abusive. You were a rebellious teenager. But you were rebellious, 30-some-odd years ago. Were there mysteries that this character had for you that were partly maybe because of the times, because he's rebelling in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and there are some things from what he might get tattooed to what he might be listening to, mm-hmm. to how he's going to act out his rebellious feelings, you know, that would be different from yours.
Oh, yeah, sure. The main thing, I think probably the most obvious thing, is drugs. When I was 16, I stole a car and ran across the country and disappeared for 3 months and, you know, did some of the destructive and angry things that the Bone does and that a lot of kids do. But there wasn't the danger. I couldn't step into the world of drugs that easily and that quickly. I would have had to have really worked hard to do that. And this was, you know, in the late 50s. And Bone doesn't have to work hard. It's in the air he breathes. I mean, it's easier for kids to buy illegal substances than it is for them to buy alcohol when you're under 16. Much easier, and it's just in the world for them. So that's a huge difference. The whole drug culture is a huge difference, and the drug economy. When I was a kid, it was a tiny sub economy. I mean, it didn't really exist as such, but today it's a major part of the economy. So that's a huge factor, a difference. The other difference, I know, looking at Bone and when I got into him, was the issue of race. America was much more segregated when I was growing up, and you could grow up a white kid and into adolescence and drop out and move about the country and so forth. And if you were a white kid, you would never really be forced to deal with the issue of race. It was still a kind of invisible topic for you, unless you happen to end up in unusual circumstances. Whereas for Bone, it's you know, it's there instantly.
Did you steal from your parents?
Sure. Did you?
Actually, no. And I'm not just saying that because they might be listening. No, I really didn't. So what did you take?
Oh, small things, you know, things I wanted for myself. The worst thing I think I did was I stole, well, should I be saying this on national radio? I stole my grandfather's watch and claimed that it was my own and was eventually caught. But It was a kind of a symbolic act, I think, because my grandfather was a watchmaker. And I guess maybe I was trying to steal his identity in some way.
Did you try to pawn it? Or did you just want the act of claiming it as
your
own?
I just wanted the act. I wanted to wear it, and I wanted it on my arm. But I stole a car. I stole. I didn't steal with any compulsion, I don't think. I shoplifted. I think a lot of kids do that. Try it out. It's testing the limits, testing the edges, I think, trying to define the cause and effect of our relations between yourself and the larger world.
Some of the characters in this book are substitute father figures for Bone, for the teenager. One guy is big in the Hell's Angels. Another guy is small in kiddie porn. There's a Rastafarian who basically becomes his mentor. Mm-hmm. Do you think a kid with an abusive father is basically an easy target in a way for false father figures?
Oh, sure. I think that... a kid, yeah, with an abusive father, without a father, or with a father who himself feels inadequate or unsure of how he's supposed to protect and teach a son or a child of either gender, is bound to go searching for a substitute.
Did you?
Oh, sure, I did, yeah. I mean, you start moving out from your own immediate family almost immediately as soon as that person in your immediate family fails you, you're going to go looking for it.
Did you find any father figures that led you in the wrong direction?
Oh, sure. And a few that led me in the right direction, too.
I imagine some of the ones that led you in the right direction were writing teachers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about the guys who led you in the wrong direction?
Well, yeah, there were a couple. there was a guy who was an ex-con. It was a had been a barker at strip shows in Atlantic City that I ended up traveling with. And, when I was a young guy, I'd attach myself to older guys who seemed smarter than I and more at ease in the world than I. And then sometimes, you know, you're lucky. But I don't think I was lucky until I was in my 20s. And then I began to locate men who could, who could see in me what was probably worth saving and nurture that and could... give me a sense of self-worth that allowed me to step around and eventually avoid the kinds of behavior that would have put me in jail in upstate New York by the time I was 25.
What do you think the barker from the strip show saw in you?
Well, one of the things he saw, I mean, is I had a driver's license at the time, and he didn't have one. And I could get a car in Miami and drive it across the country. And so he was actually a gambler more than he was a barker. And he was out of jail, and he was gambling, and I ran into him down in Key West when I was a kid. And I was just, I think, around 19. And he took me under his wing, as it were, but he also used me. And I think that's the kind of bad father you get, the one who's using you for something for himself.
Russell Banks is my guest. His new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Russell Banks, his new novel is called Rule of the Bone. Your father, who was abusive, left your family when you were 12. So while he was part of the family, he was always bigger than you, probably a lot bigger than you. You were a kid. Mm-hmm. Did you ever confront him as a man?
Oh, yeah. We made our peace, actually. I went back and dealt with my father very closely. I even worked alongside him. He was a plumber, and I became a plumber. And worked with him, and even lived in his house for a period too when I was in my 20s, and became never really affectionate, but close, if that's possible. It certainly was how I experienced it. We were close. I was very involved with him right up to the end of his life. He died in 1979 at 63, when I was in my 30s, and. So, yeah, we dealt. I never I think, had that kind of vengeful clarification with him, but I didn't really need it or want it by the time I was in my 20s.
There's something that I think I might have asked you about once before, but it still really interests me. You once said that your father felt that, you know, moving up in life was a betrayal, that mm-hmm. it was somehow a rebuke of the life that he had led.
Yeah.
And unless you were just doing some wheeler-dealer thing and finagling something, yeah. in which case that was fine. What do you think is the difference between the impulse to you know, sacrifice for the children so the children can have more than you do, and the impulse to feel, well, why should they have more than me? What's good enough for me is going to be good mm-hmm. enough for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a difference in believing in the American dream and no longer believing in the American dream. That if one generation sacrifices itself for the next generation, that next generation will profit from it and move up in society and be empowered in such a way as to make it even better for the third generation. It's that three-generation syndrome. And many Americans have not, after having been here for a long time, African Americans and white Americans too, who have gone through 8, 10, 15 generations in America, don't find that model, that dream doesn't describe their experience. And I think they grow bitter and mistrustful, profoundly mistrustful of anybody who separates themselves from them. By moving up, you know, and so forth. It isn't that they just accept their fate, it's that they feel there is no realistic alternative. And if you're advancing yourself in society, you're rejecting them. It's a way of disconnecting yourself from them.
So tell me more about why you think your father felt that, you know, if one of his kids moved up, it was somehow a betrayal.
Well, it probably, since he didn't feel he was sacrificing in his youth. My father's a very bright man, very gifted man in many ways. He was a child of the Depression, went to work when he was 16 and dropped out of school and worked with his hands his entire life. And he was bitter about that, I think, and didn't feel as though that was he was sacrificing anything. So he was in some ways not connected to his own children, the next generation, to their future. And so by having that sense of disconnectedness, if I didn't live his life exactly, more or less the same, I challenged and humiliated him for that. It wasn't as though, you know, by my living a different kind of life, I validated and justified a sacrifice on his part.
Do you think that held you back for a long time?
I think it injured my sense of self-esteem and made me feel for a long time essentially inadequate and incapable of achieving. I wasn't raised to believe that, really, that anything was possible for me and that my parents were sacrificing in order to advance me in the world. So, yeah, I think that there was a bit of a disability there. But on the other hand, it made me, in a way, more the master of my own fate, too. I didn't owe anything to anybody backwards in time, you know. Whatever I got, one way or the other, I got it myself.
Was there a teacher who helped kind of counteract that sense of advancement as betrayal?
Yeah, early on, in my early 20s, I had the great good fortune to run into the novelist Nelson Algren, when he was in his late 40s and I was in my early 20s, and it was purely, you know, fortuitous. And he read some of the stories that I was then writing, and I was working as a pipe fitter actually in Concord, New Hampshire at the time, and had gone up to Breadloaf Writers Conference because I admired his work, and I saw his name on an advertisement, and had taken a week off work and drove up to Vermont to be a participant in this conference, and he. This is another case of a guy who was glad I had a driver's license to befriend me because Algren, like a lot of American novelists of the open road, didn't have a driver's license, like Jack Kerouac, and needed me to drive him around, so which I happily did. But he was a little larger than that and had a greater sense of his own responsibility and power than that, and became a kind of a mentor and model in some ways for me, very important ways when I was a young writer. that lasted, and they last even to today. I mean, I'll still sometimes find myself saying, well, I wonder what Nelson would do now. What would he say here? How would he handle this situation?
Did he help you figure out that you could use the stuff of your life as the subject of fiction?
Yeah, absolutely. That you could bear witness, and that bearing witness was important and at the center of American literature, really, and going back to Whitman.
I want to get back to the teaching in prison that you did, which helped inspire Rule of the Bone, your new novel. You obviously got a lot out of teaching there.
Well, it's very brief, and you know, not an extensive experience, but I was able to extrapolate, you know, from it quickly.
What did you want to give? I mean, did you think, well, I'll help these guys become professional writers? So what was it that you thought helping them to write would give them?
Well, I think perhaps just maybe give them an ability, which they already had the ability, but just help to tap and shape that ability to tell their own story. We all need to construct a narrative for our lives in order to make them meaningful, in order to make moral sense out of them. Otherwise, it's just a kind of kaleidoscope of images and memories, and that's essentially meaningless. And so it's just give them an opportunity to tell their story, to help organize the material and put it in sequence and give it some structure and give them the understanding that their language was sufficiently powerful to construct a believable narrative of their lives. And they were in a context with each other where they could challenge each other interestingly and usefully. They could say, oh, come on, man, it doesn't work that way. Or, you know, come on, man, you deserved that. What are you saying? This is just special pleading. You know, they could could check it against their own realities, each other's realities, and not get away with anything. And so that was very helpful for them.
You've hit on something that really interests me, the idea that you need to construct a narrative to find meaning in your life. Otherwise, it's just this wash of
experience. Otherwise, we have to inherit the one that's given to us, you know, which is often a demoralizing and humiliating narrative. And say, oh, well, you're just that kind of kid, or you're just that kind of man or woman who, you know, we hear those stereotypical narratives all the time. And they're almost always humiliating and demeaning. But the real authentic existential narrative of our own life is what gives it its moral significance and reality.
Well, I really believe that, too. And, I mean, that's what I love about a lot of great fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, in a really teeny tiny way, that's what you try to offer on an interview show, is a chance for those narratives to be told. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, I have this terrible feeling that in America, everybody is being encouraged now to build these fake narratives.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To just go on afternoon talk shows and accuse your mother of having, you know, hurt you in some great or small way. Or to market your story in some kind of public relations type of way to sell yourself or to sell a product. And I feel like everybody's walking around now with the kind of false and true narrative construction of their lives.
All right, I agree. I mean, and so many of them are well, what makes them false is that they're basically simplistic. You explain your life in these really reductive, simplistic, causal ways, rather than admitting into them the complexity of motives and circumstances that actually do create your life.
Russell Banks, he has a new novel called Rule of the Bone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, keeping government clean. We talk with Fred Wertheimer, who recently stepped down as president of Common Cause, the nonpartisan citizens' lobby group. Over the years, Wertheimer has led the charge to reform campaign financing and strengthen congressional ethics rules. The Wall Street Journal called him the Capitol's most vocal crusader for reforming the political system. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Matthew Sweet's new recording, 100% Fun. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he's going to fight off any congressional attempt to repeal the assault weapons ban. He says the ban will stay in place as long as he is president, no matter what the National Rifle Association says. Mr. Clinton spoke today at a memorial service for law officers killed in the line of duty. He used the occasion to praise former President Bush for dropping his membership in the NRA. Mr. Bush has left the group, which advocates rights for gun owners. He was unhappy over a fundraising letter the group sent out, calling federal officers, quote, jack-booted thugs. Mr. Clinton also denounced the NRA for its language.
Law enforcement officers in this country deserve our respect and support. No one has the right to run them down or to suggest that somehow it is all right for them to be put in harm's way. That is not the American way, and anybody who does it ought to be ashamed of themselves.
President Clinton. The former maker of breast implants, Dow Corning, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The firm says it has to take the action to fend off more health claims stemming from the implants. Dow Corning denies there's any connection between the implants and health problems. The firm says it's filing immediately, stops nearly 200 lawsuits it faces in the next 6 months. Dow Corning hopes to keep committed $2 billion in its global settlement that arose from a class action lawsuit stemming from the implants. The House of Representatives probably won't pass a counterterrorism bill before the Memorial Day recess, as originally intended by Speaker Newt Gingrich. Lawmakers are grappling with constitutional and civil liberties issues that have been raised by the bill. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta has denounced what he called diversionary tactics to delay the anti-terrorism legislation by focusing on the federal raids at Waco and Ruby Ridge, Idaho. But an aide to the House Judiciary Committee says hearings on Waco won't be held at least until July, and the terrorism bill should be ready for a vote next month. Lawmakers have been trying to strike a balance between strengthening domestic and international counterterrorism efforts and protecting civil liberties. Concerns have been raised about a number of the administration's ideas, such as using the military in some cases or deporting suspected terrorists under streamlined procedures. The Senate has all but wrapped up its hearings on the legislation, but there's no word on when it will come to the floor for a vote. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The White House Chief of Staff says Republicans are not speaking with one voice on taxes. Leon Panetta told NBC today the Clinton administration isn't sure what the GOP's message is on taxes. He points out the Budget Committee in the House calls for a huge tax cut plan, but the Senate Budget Committee includes no tax cut in its plan. On Wall Street, stock prices were up today. The Dow gained nearly 7 points to end at 4,437. This is NPR. The former head of France's National Blood Bank was released from prison today after spending 30 months in jail for the distribution of AIDS-tainted blood in France. More than 400 hemophiliacs in that country have died from AIDS. More than 1,200 have been infected with the virus. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
A prison spokeswoman said the former medical official, Michel Garreta, has been released on parole after serving 30 months in jail. He was sentenced in 1992 to a four-year prison sentence for knowingly distributing blood products tainted with the AIDS virus. Journalists camped outside the prison didn't see him released. Some speculated that he had been ushered out in secret to avoid publicity. Garreta was eligible for parole for good behavior in February, but prison officials were worried about causing an uproar if they let him go. He's not allowed to leave the European community. Hemophiliacs are angry about his release, and they hope to see him return to jail. They filed charges against him for poisoning, which could put him behind bars for life. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Clinton administration is soon expected to announce proposed sanctions against Japan, but a senior U.S. official in Tokyo says they hope the trade weapon won't be needed. Trade talks between the United States and Japan broke down a week ago. Cars and car parts make up some 60% of Japan's annual trade surplus. That surplus reached a record $66 billion last year. There are reports several Japanese luxury cars will be targeted for punitive tariffs. U.S. officials are pressing for more help in resolving cases of U.S. service personnel missing from the Vietnam War. U.S. officials met with a Vietnamese prime minister today. They also spoke with officials from several Vietnamese ministries. Assistant Secretary of State Winston Lord says the talks focused primarily on the more than 1,600 Americans unaccounted for in Vietnam. He says the delegation also discussed regional security and human rights conditions in Vietnam. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fred Wertheimer has helped lead the fight to reform campaign financing, strengthen congressional ethics rules, and rein in special interest groups. After 14 years as president of Common Cause, the nonpartisan citizens' lobby group, he recently stepped down to make way for a new president. He had worked for Common Cause for 24 years. ABC World News Tonight described him as Washington's most visible and arguably most powerful ethics watchdog. The New York Times said he worked to expose the incestuous ties between lawmakers and special interests, and there were countless occasions during his tenure as president when Wertheimer might have been voted the least popular lobbyist on Capitol Hill. Earlier today, I asked Fred Wertheimer, what is the one aspect of lobbying he'd most like to reform?
Well, it would be a dramatic reform of the way in which we finance our campaigns. In its simplest terms, if our elected officials could run for office competitively, in competitive races, without being dependent on people to put up a lot of money, then at least we would have our best chance at getting what democracy is about, which is our best shot at the best views of those we elect to represent us. We're never going to get representatives who agree with everything each of us think as individuals, but we're supposed to get people who are giving us our best judgment, and they can't do that when they're obligated to people putting up a lot of money. I think it would help a lot to deal with the cynicism, the alienation, and the lack of confidence in this country in the honesty and the straightness of this political system.
Campaign finance reform, this is something you've worked on for many years. Do you think things have changed for the better?
Well, they did for a while. Certainly the creation of the presidential campaign finance system after Watergate was a tremendous advance. It has worked well. But then the parties came along and they figured out a way to evade that system, and they have blocked legislation to correct the problems. So if we look at it today, we have a very, very dramatic fundamental problem in the way campaigns are financed for Congress. And we have a big problem with the presidential system that can be fixed and should be fixed by closing down the loopholes. Instead, the Republicans just proposed to do away with the presidential campaign finance system that came out of Watergate.
When you talk about loopholes, you're talking about soft money?
I'm talking about the system, the soft money system, that is really an excuse for huge illegal contributions from corporations, wealthy individuals, labor unions to come in the back door through the political parties to be back in the presidential elections.
Let me ask you to explain what soft money means.
Well, it's a very non-threatening term, soft money. I wish we had better words to describe it. Corporation cannot give a penny in contributions to influence a federal election under a provision that's existed since 1907. An individual have contribution limits. They can only give $1,000 to a candidate in a primary of a presidential election, and the full election is publicly financed. What happens is, instead of giving the money to the candidates because it's illegal, the individual or the corporation or the labor union will give $100,000 to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party And then they will go out and spend it to benefit the candidates. So it becomes kind of a laundering process. And we have literally had tens and tens of millions of dollars from corporate America going to both the Democratic and the Republican Party in recent years, buying enormous influence in this town, all in the guise of, quote, soft money.
I know you would like to see caps on campaign financing. How do you think that would change politics in America?
Well, I think if we could control the money, we could and both cap the system and get some clean resources into it, like free TV or free mailings or matching funds financed by the public for small contributions. I think you could do three things. We could have much more competitive elections for Congress than we have now. We could greatly reduce the ability of lobbyists and interest groups to buy influence over congressional decisions. And I think we could help begin restoring public confidence that citizens are getting a fair deal in Washington. Obviously, you can't cure everything with campaign finance reform. But if we could reform the system, I think we could get back closer to the notions of our democracy than we have today.
Fred Wertheimer is my guest, and he recently stepped down after 14 years as the president of Common Cause. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fred Wertheimer. He recently stepped down after 14 years as president of Common Cause. Common Cause is a citizens lobby which lobbies for campaign finance reform and around issues pertaining to the ethics of legislators and special interest groups. The Senate is beginning work on examining the legislation that the House passed as part of the Contract with America. What are the lobbies for us to keep our eyes on as the Senate discusses the contract?
Well, I think you'd be safe watching every lobby in the country. Everything is at stake in this budget. There are all kinds of questions for corporations. There are tax questions for corporations. There are subsidy programs. There are the agriculture. The entire agriculture system is going to be up. There are questions, obviously, for senior citizens. Labor unions have large stakes. All of the lobbies have very large stakes. And one of the questions is going to be who wins and who loses in this battleground. And here again, I believe that if the Republicans do not act to clean up the system at the same time that they're making these decisions, and if in fact they wind up tilting their decisions to the lobbies that provide huge sums of money for them, they're going to run into a lot of credibility problems down the road.
The NRA has been in the news a lot lately since the bombing of Oklahoma City. President Bush just resigned from the NRA because of a letter that he thought was very inflammatory that talked about federal agents as, you know, jackbooted, comparing them to Nazis. It's been said that the NRA has moved to the right, and some people have resigned in protest from the NRA because of that. Do you think that the lobbying techniques of the NRA have been changing?
Well, it's not just the lobbying techniques of the NRA. I don't know that they've moved to the right, but they've certainly become, it certainly appears they've become much harsher in their rhetoric. But, you know, this is a problem for our whole political system. Our campaigns are very negative and nasty. Our elected officials come to Washington. They seem to be running for office every day, round the clock. The battles are very harsh and negative. The polarization that has taken place in our politics is very widespread, and it's a problem for all of us. And I think what the NRA example has done is it's one of those moments that has captured for the country in a very stark way a very deep problem we have. The media plays its role because it's the messenger, and it tends to be attracted to the confrontational battleground messages. Now, people could say that about Common Cause or about some of the things and arguments I've made over the years, and I'm sure they would. All of us, I think, have to take a step back and see where we've come, because the harshness and the negative nature of our politics is turning off the whole country.
There is a lot of cynicism about American politics. Among extremists, that cynicism has hardened into hatred, people who are almost ready to arm themselves to oppose, to fight the government. Your job is to monitor government and to reform corrupting aspects of politics. Do you think of yourself as being cynical about American government?
I am not cynical. I happen to have optimistic genes in my body. But I'm not cynical. I don't think people should be cynical. I think if we work to make our democracy work, it will work. And I think people have to get in and be part of it. I think the hatred that has come to the table has to be publicly challenged and forcefully challenged. And I think what President Bush recently did in challenging that kind of hatred and the kind of language that was used was
in his letter to the NRA.
In his letter to the NRA was enormously beneficial. You know, there's so much out there in the way of ideas and issues, et cetera, that it's very hard to capture the public's attentions. But every now and then you have defining moments that you can build off of. And I think what's happened recently, what President Bush's letter captured, is a call to all of us to recognize that that we can't accept the kind of hatred, we can't accept the kind of attacks without challenging them. Now, you challenge them in the political arena, you challenge them in the debate, you challenge them in elections, and we have to do that. The cynicism is too great in this country.
You came to Washington, D.C. first to work as an aide to a Republican congressman.
Yes.
From Massachusetts. Did you plan to go into politics at the time?
No, I didn't. I was simply kind of stumbling along one step at a time. I had worked for the Securities and Exchange Commission. I always wanted to work on Capitol Hill. I was always fascinated with Congress. And I simply wrote up there, kept writing letters, and this congressman needed someone, and up there I went for 4 years.
What turned you into a watchdog?
Well, I just stumbled along. Not exactly, but after I left Capitol Hill, I took some time, as I'm doing now, because I wanted to find something I would enjoy doing. And Common Cause was just being created, and it was an organization that was going to work to make government work, to make democracy work, and that just appealed to me. So I went over there and got hired as a lobbyist, and I thought I'd stay for about 2 years and move to my next job. And I did move to my next job, but it was 24 years later, not 2 years later. When I first got there, I was given two issues to work on. Legislation to end U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, and legislation to reform the campaign finance system. So I stopped working on the first one in the mid-1970s and wound up working on the campaign finance reform issue for 25 years. And whatever I wind up doing, I'm going to continue working on that issue until the battle is won.
You're making something of a career change. You're going to be staying basically in the same line of work. But, you've stepped down from the presidency of Common Cause. There's change in the works, and you're trying to figure out what next. So what do you do in the meantime? How are you spending your days? How are you filling your time? And what's your process for figuring out what to do next?
Well, I'm trying to think through some of the issues that I've talked about, the question of the role.
But how do you spend your day?
How do I spend my day?
You wake up, you have a full day ahead. You don't have appointments you have to get to,
no,
an office?
I have some office space.
Mm-hmm.
I have office space. I'm having a very hard time breaking my body from the habit of getting up in the morning and going immediately into this office space. In fact, I haven't broken the habit yet. I hope to. So I go into the office. As I always have, I am a habitual newspaper reader. So I do that. I have been helping out on some projects. I worked in the effort against the constitutional amendment for a balanced budget because I don't believe the Constitution is the place to work this process out. I've worked on some projects. I am doing some reading. I am dealing with my total incapacity to use the computer. I am learning how to use the computer. Through that, trying to think my way through the various kinds of projects I could work on. So I type very slowly on my computer, so that takes up more of the day. So I am very, very confident that I am going to find and be able to create an opportunity to go out and be involved at really what I think is one of the most extraordinary times in this country's recent history. This is the most important debate about our society and the role of government in 60 years. And it's going to go on for the next 3 or 4 or 10 years. And I want to be part of it. And I know I'm going to find some way to do that.
Fred Wertheimer is the former president of the citizens' lobby group Common Cause. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton today said he's going to stand fast on the assault weapons ban. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson, our White House correspondent, is covering the speech. The president laid that marker down in a talk to law enforcement officials. We'll also have a story from Detroit. Don Gagne has visited a gun show and talked to people who are sympathetic to those folks in the Michigan militia. We'll be covering the Dow Corning story. We have a report on school prayer, one of the major issues of the second 100 days. Michael Scholar will report on the Ebola virus outbreak in Zaire, and there's been a new discovery of tombs in Egypt.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The title of Matthew Sweet's new album, 100% Fun, is intended ironically. As rock critic Ken Tucker observes, there's always a set of more complicated emotions working within Sweet's brisk, often cheerful melodies.
Sweet is a forward-thinking throwback. Listening to the way he surrounds his thin, reedy voice with loud, jangling guitars and catchy choruses, you just know that this is a smart guy who grew up nursing his unhappiness with doses of the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and the Birds. When he got a little older, he must have recognized that the punk rock of the late 70s and early 80s wasn't just noise. It was pop with a subtext, with a purpose, with a vengeance.
Something in your eyes that is keeping my hope alive. But I'm
Over the course of 5 albums now, Sweet's achievement has been to recognize that there's something compelling and poignant and even mysterious about misery with a happy face pasted over it. The song I just played, Sick of Myself, is a little masterpiece of shrewd self-loathing, with Matthew hoping to prove his love for a woman by exalting her and debasing himself. Sweet likes to make himself seem like a whipped puppy, but you know darn well he's also a hound dog. He'll do anything to keep a girl interested and intrigued. One of the things I like most about Sweet is that he really seems to love women and is completely willing to immerse himself in their concerns and obsessions because he knows they probably mirror his own. On 100% Fun, Matthew Sweet is working once again with the guitarists Robert Lloyd and Robert Quine. They're both punk vets. Lloyd was a founding member of the New York band Television. Quine was part of Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Sweet uses their brutal sounds as the perfect contrast to his singing. Without the guitar's rough, jagged strength, his singing would be too faint and wimpy. As always, it's Sweet's sourness that makes his music so good.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation. Additional support comes from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.